to my page on KBOO.FM Wednesday Talk Radio. Read this article, Why I Teach White History Month in February, by Diallo Kenyatta, an African-American activist and writer out of Chicago, who again has his own website, DialloKenyatta.com. Looks like I'm just out of time, so thank everybody for listening. Thank all of you who called in, and talk to you next week. Bye, everybody.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 8:59 a.m.
Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Talk and Taste, Getting Vaccinated for the Love of Health, hosted by Preserve Coalition. On Wednesday, February 10th, from 1:30 to 3:30 p.m., streaming online. Talk and Taste is a virtual afternoon of engaging activities, cooking demonstrations, informative talks, and dance and exercise lessons hosted by LaTroy Robinson. Again, that's Talk and Taste, Getting Vaccinated for the Love of Health, hosted by Preserve Coalition. On Wednesday, February 10th, from 1:30 to 3:30 p.m., streaming online. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available on our website at kbu.fm. Due to the temporary closures of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Program Advisory Committee meets on the second Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kbu.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, a one-hour special on Stokely Carmichael, also known as Kwame Ture. He is known by a generation for popularizing the cry of Black Power. We speak with Dr. Peniel Joseph about his book, Stokely Alight. How did the concept of Black Power as a political strategy develop? How and why did Stokely Carmichael move from civil rights worker to U.S.-based Black Power leader to Pan-Africanist and socialist? What price did he pay? We have a wide-ranging conversation on Stokely's life, impact, and contributions. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
I'm Max Pringle with these headlines. The Biden administration is taking steps to address harm to thousands of families that were separated at the U.S.-Mexico border. President Biden is issuing 9 executive orders on family separations, border security, and legal immigration during his first 2 weeks in office. Biden has proposed a task force on family unification.
I will accomplish what I said I would do. a much more humane policy based on family unification.
The moves aim to reverse many of former President Trump's zero-tolerance policies to deter immigration, both legal and illegal. Biden's nominee as Homeland Security Secretary, Alejandro Mayorkas, would lead the task force on family separation, focused largely on reuniting parents and children who remain apart. Parts of northern New England are awaiting their turn to be pummeled by a heavy winter storm. Tuesday's snowfall comes as residents of the New York City region are digging out from under piles of snow that shut down public transport, canceled flights, and closed coronavirus vaccination sites. The storm dropped more than 16 inches of snow in Manhattan Central Park, and as much as 30 inches were reported in northern New Jersey. The National Weather Service says a foot or more could fall on the ground in New England by the time the snow finally tapers off in the northernmost states by Wednesday evening. Russia's opposition leader Alexei Navalny is facing a court hearing that could end with him being sent to prison for years. Navalny is an anti-corruption investigator who is President Vladimir Putin's most prominent critic. He was arrested January 17th upon returning from Germany, where he spent 5 months recuperating from a nerve agent poisoning that he blames on the Kremlin. Benji Heyer reports.
Protests are taking place in Moscow as opposition leader Alexei Navalny faces a court hearing. He could be sentenced to 2.5 years in prison after being arrested having returned to Russia from Germany, where he received treatment for a nerve agent poisoning for which he holds the Russian government responsible, a claim the Kremlin denies.
And that's Benji Heyer reporting. The city of Rochester, New York, has suspended police officers seen in body camera videos pepper spraying a distressed, handcuffed 9-year-old girl. A press release from the city Monday did not specify how many officers were suspended. The suspensions will last at least until an internal police investigation is completed. Mayor Lovely Warren said video of the incident shocked her.
I could hear the words of this child coming out of my child's mouth. This is not something that any of us should want to justify, can justify, and it's something we have to change.
The action comes as community outrage continues to grow following the release of the footage Sunday showing officers restraining and scolding the girl who was screaming for her father. The police were responding to a report of family trouble. New York Attorney General Letitia James says her office is looking into what happened. A Capitol police officer who died as a result of injuries sustained defending the Capitol on January 6th will be honored today at the Capitol. U.S. Capitol Police Officer Brian Sicknick will lie in honor in the Capitol Rotunda. Sicknick died from head injuries during the hours-long fight for control of the U.S. Capitol. A viewing period will begin this evening for members of the U.S. Capitol Police and continue overnight. The move comes after multiple lawmakers had called for Sicknick to be honored at the Capitol. Two GOP lawmakers from South Carolina had introduced a bill that would allow Sicknick to lie in honor at the Capitol before his burial at Arlington National Cemetery. Representative Ralph Norman and Senator Tim Scott introduced the legislation Thursday. If passed, a plaque would be placed in the Capitol in memory of Sicknick and would allow the House Sergeant-at-Arms to pay for Sicknick's funeral services. A study out today shows that a Russian vaccine is more than 90% effective against the coronavirus. The results of the peer-reviewed study were published in the British medical journal Lancet. The news is a boost for the shot that is increasingly being purchased by nations around the world who are desperate to get a handle on the pandemic. Researchers say, based on the trial, which involved about 20,000 people in Russia last fall, the vaccine is about 91% effective, and that the shot also appeared to prevent people from becoming severely ill with COVID-19. The Sputnik V vaccine was approved by the Russian government with much fanfare on August 11th. President Vladimir Putin personally broke the news on national television and said that one of his daughters had already been vaccinated with it. At the time, the vaccine had only been tested in several dozens of people.
That was our news headlines. We focus this hour on the life and impact of Stokely Carmichael, also known by his African name, Kwame Ture. Let's hear an excerpt from Stokely Carmichael's 1966 speech at the University of California, Berkeley.
Now then, in order to understand white supremacy, we must dismiss the fallacious notion that white people can give anybody their freedom. No man can give anybody his freedom. A man is born free. You may enslave a man after he is born free. And that is, in fact, what this country does. It enslaves black people after they're born. So that the only act that white people can do is to stop denying black people their freedom. That is, they must stop denying freedom. They never give it to anyone. Now, we want to take that to its logical extension so that we could understand then what its relevancy would be in terms of new civil rights bills. I maintain that every civil rights bill in this country was passed for white people, not for black people. For example, I am black. I know that. I also know that while I am black, I am a human being. Therefore, I have the right to go into any public place. White people didn't know that. Every time I tried to go into a place, they stopped me. So some boys had to write a bill to tell that white man he's a human being. Don't stop him. That bill was for that white man, not for me. I knew it all the time. I knew that I could vote, and that wasn't a privilege, it was my right. Every time I tried, I was shot, killed, or jailed, beaten, or economically deprived. So somebody had to write a bill for white people to tell them, when a black man comes to vote, don't bother him. That bill, again, was for white people, not for black people. So that when you talk about open occupancy, I know I can live any place I want to live. It is white people across this country who are incapable of allowing me to live where I want to live. You need a civil rights bill, not me. I know I can live where I want to live.
Dr. Peniel Joseph is a professor of history at Tufts University and the founding director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy. He is the author of the book, Stokely a Life, a biography of iconic civil rights leader Stokely Carmichael. Dr. Joseph is also the author of the award-winning Waiting Till the Midnight Hour, A Narrative History of Black Power in America, and Dark Days, Bright Nights, From Black Power to Barack Obama. Dr. Peniel Joseph stopped by our studios when he was in Los Angeles on his book tour. Here is what the New York Times had to say about Stokely a Life. They say, quote, in chronicling the life of the activist intellectual Stokely Carmichael in Stokely a Life, an insightful, highly engaging, and fluently written biography, the historian Peniel E. Joseph has shed light on one critical, if largely overlooked, part of that journey. And there you have a rather glowing review by the New York Times. It's entitled Evolution of an Activist. Let's go to our interview now with Dr. Peniel Joseph. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me, Margaret.
All righty. So, Stokely, a Life, a book about Stokely Carmichael. What got you interested in doing a book on Stokely?
Well, I mean, my mother is really my first teacher and historian and mm-hmm. really an activist. And I'm the son of Haitian immigrants who
came
to the United States in 1965. So I was raised by a single mother in New York City. And she worked for Mount Sinai Hospital and was part of the 1199 Hospital Workers Union. So I was on my first picket line when I was in elementary school. So,
well, we have a kind of a similar story because I'm also from the islands, from Barbados,
yes.
And emigrated to Brooklyn,
yep.
And you know, got involved in the movement from there.
Yeah, right? we actually lived in Brooklyn and then moved to Queens.
Oh, okay.
So it's a very interesting story as well. Yeah,
Crown Heights in Brooklyn,
and we were off of Eastern Parkway in Brooklyn.
Yeah, yeah. I used to live on Eastern Parkway at some point. Yeah,
and so I got interested in political mm-hmm. activism through my mother. So I was reading about Haitian history and the Black Jacobins by C.L.R. James when I was 10 years old. So Stokely Carmichael came into my consciousness at a very, very young age, and it got reinforced through the Eyes on the Prize television series, which was mm-hmm. Henry Hampton, who's the African-American executive producer of that. That's coming out of Boston's Black Side Productions, and journalists like Callie Crossley and others were working on that. And so Stokely became part of my education in terms of the civil rights movement. And as I grew up into high school, was very, very active, college, very, very active around many different issues, including Haitian refugees in Guantanamo, you know, anti-death penalty work. You know, Al Sharpton was there, Sonny Carson, all these different activists in New York. And so Stokely became somebody who I was pursuing. People talked about Malcolm X, Dr. King, but Stokely really came into my consciousness. And so through doing work on the Black Power movement, I went to Temple University for my PhD. This was around the time that there was really a lot of activism around Mumia Abu-Jamal, who was on death row, former Black Panther, around welfare rights, Kensington welfare rights activism in and around Philadelphia, especially North Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. You know, I taught high school in Philadelphia while doing my PhD. So Stokely was always, you know, in the back of my mind, Stokely Carmichael Kwame Ture. And I got a chance to see Kwame Ture in Philadelphia when he gave a speech at University of Pennsylvania before he was diagnosed with cancer. So he was hugely charismatic. He was talking about imperialism. He was talking about capitalism. He was talking about racial oppression. And I got the chance to see him, shake his hand, briefly speak to him. And then when I was doing my dissertation, I did a dissertation on the Black Power movement. And that turned into my first book, which was called Waiting Till the Midnight Hour. And the deeper I did research, the more I was interested in Stokely Carmichael Kwame Ture.
Right. And of course, Stokely Carmichael Kwame, who later changed his name to Kwame Ture, born in Port of Spain in Trinidad and Tobago, also hailed from the Caribbean. So you were kind of grounded in that experience in your youth with your mom, labor union, Black Power movement as a student activist, you know, et cetera. So getting more into the book itself and the life of Stokely Carmichael, of course, a very controversial, you know, figure. And a lot of people remember, of course, he's mainly remembered for his cry of Black Power. And various other people have also staked the claim on coming up, you know, with that term. There are lots of stories I hear in the movement, you know, around that. But tell us then about Stokely's early years, his formative years then, as he becomes more of a national leader, but prior to that.
Well, yeah, he's born June 29th, 1941 in Port of Spain, Trinidad. And what's interesting is that Stokely's parents both leave for the United States when he's really a tiny baby. Mm. And so he's raised by his paternal grandmother, Cecilia, and he's raised by his aunts as well, right? So he's really the middle child of five. He's the only boy. He's the only son. He's really going to be somebody who is always identifying with underdogs, even in Trinidad. Even as a young man, he's a sharp dresser. They call him Little Man, who's mm-hmm. in the little suits that his all these strong Black women who are raising him dress him in. He goes to a little intermediary school on the island in Port of Spain, Trinidad. He's hugely precocious, hugely smart and intelligent. He always remembers Trinidad because he leaves Trinidad 2 weeks before his 11th birthday, but he's inculcated in both the Caribbean tradition, but also the British tradition, right? He remembers when Princess Margaret comes to the island and he's waving the flag at 10 years old. This is a memory that he's later going to say he's embarrassed by the time he's in London in 1967. He's looking at a portrait of Princess Margaret and he's saying, why is everybody so obsessed with British royalty? But he used to be too, as just a young boy. He comes to New York City in 1952. And what's interesting is he's reunited with his family after not seeing his mother for 6-7 years, after not seeing his father. So he has to get reacclimated. Him and his sisters come back to New York City, and there's two more sisters that have been born while they were still in Trinidad. So what's interesting is the Carmichael clan gets reunited, and they move to the Morris Park section of the Bronx. His father, Adolphus Carmichael, who's a carpenter who had built the house he grew up in Trinidad, is really now a jack of all trades, a taxi cab driver. His mother, Mae Charles, is a homemaker but a firebrand. She's the one who Stokely takes his temperament really after. And so what's interesting is that he moves to a predominantly white section of the Bronx, predominantly Italian. His friends become predominantly white, predominantly Italian. He goes to Bronx Science High School. He tests into that school. That's a very competitive school to test into.
Yeah, it is.
Mm-hmm. Predominantly Jewish school. And what's interesting is that he really becomes part of multiple worlds. On one level, he's got the Caribbean background. On another level, he's running with this predominantly Italian kids in his neighborhood. He's also going to Harlem, where he's getting his hair cut. And he's hearing street speakers in Harlem, including Nation of Islam, but street speakers who are talking about the African Revolution in the 1950s. Mm-hmm. He's hearing about Emmett Till. Emmett Till is assassinated and lynched in 1955, 14-year-old black boy from Chicago, lynched in Money, Mississippi. Stokely is the same age as Emmett Till when Emmett Till is lynched. So he's hearing about the civil rights movement. He's hearing about Malcolm X, and he's also participating in left-wing study groups where they're reading Marxism, they're reading socialism. Now, the black socialist tradition is going to be very, very important for the young Stokely Carmichael because he's going to be introduced to Bayard Rustin. Mm-hmm. And Bayard Rustin is the leading black socialist along with A. Philip Randolph in the United States. And what's interesting about Bayard Rustin is that Rustin belongs to a black radical social democratic tradition, a tradition of activism, organizing, pacifism. He had been incarcerated for being a conscientious objector during World War II. He had visited Africa. He had visited India. He schooled, mentored Martin Luther King Jr. in Montgomery, Alabama. Rustin was also openly homosexual, so he was also on the margins of the movement because of being arrested on morals charges. When Stokely first sees Bayard Rustin, he asks, who is that speaking at a rally? He's told that that's Bayard Rustin, the socialist, and he says, that's who I want to be. So mm-hmm. he's gonna have all these different streams of activism. I should add that he's also organizing in Harlem as a teenager. So before he joined SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, Stokely Carmichael is political. He's politicized, but he's also global. One of the things we have to remember with Stokely, he doesn't discover Pan-Africanism in the 1960s. He was in a Pan-African context in the 1950s.
He was grounded in it, part of his education.
Absolutely.
Political education.
He's listening to Miriam Makeba as a teenager, and he tells one of his sisters that he's going to marry her as a teenager.
Right. Yeah. So that's quite something. And I guess that continues in a kind of a radical tradition that a number of us who've come from the Caribbean region, Dr. Gerald Horn writes a bit about a kind of a clandestine organization of Caribbean radicals.
Oh, absolutely.
Actually, yeah. And so who knows, how, you know, if it was open or not, you know, a connection with Stokely and that particular trend.
And you know, I think what's interesting about being from the Caribbean is that, and we see it whether it's Marcus Garvey or Hubert Harrison, is that there's such a rich connection between the Caribbean, the United States, but also Africa. So it's a rich Pan-African cultural, political connection. These folks are activists and intellectuals, and Stokely is coming out of that tradition.
Right, and grounded in much a broader international view. Okay, so jumping ahead then, he does all of this, and he winds up being a freedom writer in the South.
He winds up being a freedom writer. He goes to Howard University. What's interesting, he joins the Nonviolent Action Group, which is a SNCC affiliate at mm-hmm. Howard University. At Howard University, it's really important to remember that the professors at Howard University include Sterling Brown, the towering poet, Toni Morrison, the future Pulitzer and Nobel Prize winner, is his freshman English professor.
Amazing.
There are so many different, E. Franklin Frazier, the towering sociologist. So when we think about Howard, the Howard that Stokely Carmichael goes to from 1960 to 64 has a better faculty in my mind than Harvard University or any university in the United States. So we have to think of Howard not as just the black school, but as this towering, intellectually gigantic school with so many different luminaries. And he's also connecting with so many different young civil rights activists, people like Ed Brown, Cortland Cox, Mike Thelwell, Hank Thomas. There's going to be so many different people. So he becomes a freedom rider. He's part of SNCC. He's organizing in D.C., but he meets up with John Lewis. And Stokely gets arrested for the first time in Mississippi as a freedom rider June 8, 1961. He spends about 40 days in Parchman Penitentiary, Mississippi's worst prison farm. And he's going to be incarcerated with people like James Farmer of CORE, John Lewis of SNCC as well. And he spends his 20th birthday in jail. And that's going to be the first of many birthdays that he spends in jail. So what's interesting about Stokely in the early 1960s is that that visit to Mississippi sparked something in him. He's going to visit Mississippi every summer afterwards, and in 1964 go and live in Mississippi after graduating from Howard University. Bob Moses also inspires him. Bob Moses is the SNCC activist who really goes to, initially in 61, Macomb, Mississippi. Mm-hmm. And there's the beautiful letter that Moses smuggles out of a jail in Macomb, Mississippi, along with 13 SNCC activists in 1961, where he calls Mississippi the middle of the iceberg. And the iceberg is a metaphor for white supremacy and Jim Crow and racial oppression in the United States. And what's interesting is Stokely really, Bob Moses becomes Stokely's hero. He meets up with Moses in 1962. Part of the reason he changes his major from pre-med to philosophy is because of Bob Moses, and they spend time discussing philosophical questions. And so Stokely falls in love with Mississippi. And so when we think about between 60 and 64, he's at Howard University. He's organizing in Cambridge, Maryland with Gloria Richardson and other activists. He's organizing Route 40 demonstrations with Julius Hobson and CORE activists. He's being influenced by Ella Baker, who's the founder of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And really, Ella Baker is key here because she convinces the young people who are part of SNCC that what they're doing, there's more than meets the eye in terms of what they're doing. Her famous speech in 1960 that it's about more than just a hamburger. She's saying that it's about nothing less than democracy and radicalizing and transforming all these systems of oppression in the United States. Even if a senior civil rights leaders like Dr. King, who's only 8, 9, 10 years older than them, disagree. So there's all these influences, Fannie Lou Hamer, Annie Ponder, all these different black women who are also influencing his activism in the Delta. Stokely becomes hugely, hugely popular, not just at Howard, but anywhere he goes. Among older black people in the Delta, he adopts their folk ways. He's hugely deferential to seniors. He babysits children. He eats whatever food is in front of him. He's hugely respectful. So it's very, very important to understand that he thinks of poor black sharecroppers and poor black people as the people that can save democracy in the United States.
Yeah, and also I imagine with his roots in the Caribbean, much more rural than in the United States. I mean, when you go south and a lot of those old ways and respect for the elders and you eat your food in front of you, I mean, all of those are things that transfer over from others of us in the diaspora. I want to dig in a little bit with the time in SNCC, because the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, because you have SNCC, you've got King's Organization, SCLC, you've got the Congress of Racial Equality, you have the NAACP, the oldest civil rights organization in the country, but has this history, I guess, of being more, you know, more of the conservative, more mainstream than some of the others. And we do know that there were tensions and power struggles among them. Mm-hmm. But Stokely developed a close relationship with Martin Luther King. Tell us, you know, a bit about that, because that really played a big role in how, in his view, how he was seen and also how other people see him.
Yeah, he first meets up with Dr. King in 1963 at Howard University. Mm-hmm. And unlike other SNCC activists, Stokely puts his ego aside when it comes to King. So when people in the rural Delta ask him if he's one of King's men, he says yes. He doesn't get into an explanation. He's very impressed by Dr. King's love of black people and their love of King. Mm-hmm. And I think some of that is because he aspires to the same thing. Because King, even though he's this man of letters and he's born in the black middle class, in a way, King commits a kind of class suicide and class rejection by really identifying with the least of these. And Stokely does the same thing. So when we think about King and Stokely, they meet in 63. Stokely serves as his chauffeur in 1964 in Greenwood. They marched together in Selma in 65, which is sort of a little known fact. And Stokely moves into Lowndes County with SNCC and don't go to the main Selma demonstration. They use that demonstration to burrow deep into Lowndes County to do their independent political organizing. And they become really close along the Meredith March in 1966. They spent about 3 weeks together. In subsequent years, you know, King invites Stokely to his home in Atlanta for dinner. They speak on the phone together. They headline a major anti-war demonstration April 15th, 1967, where there's 400,000 people there. So Stokely impacts King and King impacts Stokely. I think the thing that King does for Stokely is really let him become more pragmatic and more patient in a lot of ways. He sees that Dr. King really, really loves black people, and whatever King is trying to do is because of that love. And I think Stokely always credits Dr. King with teaching him and other black people how to face racial terror without fear. That's what he says, right? Stokely impacts King just through his radicalism, his speaking truth to power, his vocal and robust anti-war activism. He teases King the night of April 15th, 1967 at Harry Belafonte's apartment. And Harry Belafonte is huge here, you know, civil rights activist, legendary freedom fighter. And they're at his apartment in New York. And Stokely's teasing King, who had come out against Vietnam 11 days earlier at the Riverside Church, mm-hmm. and saying that, you know, you're coming out against the war because of me.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is that a couple of weeks later, King calls up Stokely and says that he wants him to come to Ebenezer Baptist last mm-hmm. Sunday in April, and he wants him to hear him speak, preach. And Stokely says, you know, I'm not coming because I'm not going to be doing the Lord's work. I'm doing the people's work like a good heathen.
Yeah.
And King implores him. Stokely says, why? King says he's going to be speaking out against Vietnam. And Stokely said he's going to be in the front row of that pew. And we've got great footage from Eyes on the Prize that shows Stokely mm-hmm. Carmichael alongside of Cleve Sellers, who's his best friend,
yeah.
SNCC activist too, leading the standing ovation after King really comes out against the war that last Sunday in April at Ebenezer.
Right, and I want to dig in a little bit with this as well, because James Meredith, of